This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Welcome to the Massachusetts State House News Service, providing our listeners with high-quality, comprehensive, objective information about the activities of our state government. Today, we are covering the week of May 3rd through 10th, 2026. This program is sponsored by the Memorial Foundation for the Blind and the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind. This is Paula Simchak. Federal prosecutors on Friday expanded the criminal case against Representative Christopher Flanagan, adding charges that he laundered stolen money through his campaign account, filed false tax returns, and used misappropriated funds for personal expenses like psychic services, menswear, and a home air conditioner. The indictment supersedes charges federal prosecutors made last year. The new indictment, unsealed Friday, charges the Dennis Democrat with 8 counts of wire fraud, 1 count of money laundering, 1 count of falsification of records, and 3 counts of filing false tax returns, U.S. Attorney Leah Foley's office said. Flanagan, 38, was charged in April 2025 with 5 counts of wire fraud and 1 count of falsification of records. He pleaded not guilty at the time and has continued to serve in the House, despite calls to resign from fellow lawmakers and the governor. Prosecutors said he will appear in federal court in Boston at a later date on the expanded indictment. The new charges significantly broaden the government's allegations against the second-term representative, who serves the first Barnstable District communities of Brewster, Dennis, and portions of Yarmouth. Before his election to the House, Flanagan served from 2019 through mid-2024 as executive officer of the Home Builders and Remodelers Association of Cape Cod, a trade organization representing more than 300 members of the region's building industry. Prosecutors allege that Flanagan, who had signatory authority over the association's bank accounts and reported to its board, used that position to siphon money from HBA accounts while facing mounting personal financial problems, including overdue mortgage payments, credit card debt, and bank overdraft fees. According to the superseding indictment, from in or about November 2021 to January 2023, Flanagan stole more than $36,000 in HBA funds through transfers and checks deposited into his personal accounts, prosecutors said Friday. The indictment also alleges he stole an additional $7,287 from another association bank account between February 2021 and December 2023. Federal prosecutors allege Flanagan used the majority of the stolen funds to pay personal mortgage bills, to pay down thousands of dollars in credit card debt, and to make other personal expenditures. Among the newly detailed allegations, Foley's office said Flanagan used association funds to pay for personal psychic services in July 2022 through direct debit transactions from the Builders Group's bank account. The superseding indictment also alleges Flanagan submitted falsified expense reports to the Home Builders and Remodelers Association of Cape Cod after the organization's board questioned missing funds. According to prosecutors, Flanagan claimed certain purchases were legitimate business expenses, and they actually included personal items, such as an electric dryer and an air conditioner, both delivered to Flanagan's home, more than $1,000 in Macy's purchases for men's ties, dress shirts, slacks, and sports coats, and Target purchases for children's clothing and toys. Federal authorities additionally accused Flanagan of failing to report the allegedly stolen money on his personal tax returns for 2021, 2022, and 2023, and of failing to disclose rental income on his 2023 return. The new indictment also adds a money laundering charge tied to prosecutors' allegation that Flanagan transferred $10,000 in stolen funds through his personal bank account into his campaign account in January 2023 in order to conceal the source of the money. It is alleged that Flanagan's bank statements from the time of the deposit in January 2023 would reflect that he could not have issued the $10,000 campaign check without his theft of HBA money, showing a beginning balance of approximately $42.28 just 1 week before depositing the stolen funds, Foley's office said. It continues, in response, Flanagan allegedly provided the Office of Campaign and Political Finance with falsified expense reports that claimed that the $10,000 check from HBA constituted legitimate HBA reimbursed expenses, that HBA had a practice of allowing Flanagan to withdraw large sums of money for the purpose of expense reimbursement, and therefore the $10,000 campaign check was a legitimate donation of Flanagan's own personal funds. Friday's filing also revisits allegations from last year surrounding a 2022 campaign mailer sent under the name Conservatives for Dennis, which first drew scrutiny from OCPF. Prosecutors allege Flanagan obstructed the OCPF investigation by inventing a fictitious person named Jean Louise, who he claimed belonged to an independent conservative group supporting his candidacy. According to the indictment, Flanagan also created fake emails purporting to come from vendors involved in producing and distributing the mailer. In 2024, campaign finance regulators concluded that Flanagan violated campaign finance law and lied to investigators about the source of the mailer and related spending. Flanagan's lawyers could not be reached for comment on Friday. House Speaker Ron Mariano, who has not joined the previous calls for the representative to resign, did not return a request for comment. A Mariano spokesperson pointed out that House Ethics Chair Kate Lipper-Garabedian said last April that the Ethics Committee will conduct an investigation into Flanagan when judicial proceedings are over. Flanagan was first elected to the House in 2022 after serving on the Dennis Select Board. Federal prosecutors said Flanagan earned roughly $97,546 and $100,945 from his legislative salary in 2023 and 2024, respectively. The details contained in the charging documents are allegations, Foley's office said Friday. The defendant is presumed innocent until proven guilty beyond a reasonable doubt in a court of law. Senator Barry Feingold thinks a technological revolution is different this time around. 20-plus years ago, there was this cute little company started in Harvard called Facebook. We all thought it was nice, how these kids played Facebook with their friends at Harvard and other colleges, and we didn't understand how big this would be, Feingold said, reflecting on the introduction of the social media platform. I think this is different. I think we do understand how big AI is, how big it's going to be, the co-chair of the Committee on Economic Development and Emerging Technologies said at the Massachusetts Continuing Legal Education Conference Center in downtown Boston at a Statehouse News Service Master List event titled The AI Revolution in Massachusetts, Disruption, Risk, Opportunity. While he thinks lawmakers are a little ahead of the curve 2 decades later, he acknowledged no one really knows how far this is going to go. Massachusetts lawmakers have not passed comprehensive legislation regulating artificial intelligence. The House last year passed a bill regulating AI and campaign advertisements, and the Senate passed a data privacy bill. Both branches have passed school cell phone-related legislation, and the House bill attempts to regulate the use of social media by young people. A Feingold bill would establish guardrails for developing and deploying AI models, which are already widespread. The bill received a favorable vote from the Committee on Advanced Information Technology, the Internet, and Cybersecurity, and has been in Senate Ways and Means since October. We've had conversations with California, New York. We've been talking to the legislators there. What we've been trying to do is have bills that are very similar, so it's really what we hope would be a framework for the federal government to adopt, Feingold said. The Healey administration in February launched a ChatGPT-powered AI assistant under a contract with OpenAI. In terms of the executive branch, I would say that we are keeping pace with AI, at least at the moment, said Thomas Myers, General Counsel and Chief Privacy Officer at the Executive Office of Technology Services and Security. He called Massachusetts one of the first states to come out with a generative AI policy, establishing guardrails to monitor its use and development. At the time of the rollout, the National Association of Government Employees, which represents around 15,000 state employees, said the administration was rushing the introduction of AI and said some of its workers were concerned AI could take away job duties. A 2026 Tufts University Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy study projected Massachusetts is one of the most vulnerable states to AI when considering the proportion of jobs here that are at risk of displacement. We're not exactly sure what's going to be added. I think we're very concerned about what's going to be subtracted. But if you look at the history of technology, most times we end up adding jobs, not losing jobs, Feingold said of workforce displacement concerns. One challenge we're having is how quickly AI is moving, Feingold added. I do think we can retrain people. We're just going to need the time and resources. Endicott College Associate Professor Dr. Alan Glass called the findings sobering and said he didn't think they should be softened. The reality of the concentration of financial services, legal supports, healthcare administration in Massachusetts is going to lead to massive disruption, Glass said. Equally so, though, is the trade-off. We should be asking ourselves the question, how do we benefit from this technology to make businesses or organizations within the Massachusetts border more productive overall? Whether people trust the technology being introduced is a big part of the conversation, panelists agreed. If people do not trust the technology, if people do not trust how it's developed, If people don't trust who's developing it, then you're going to have the problem of deployment and adoption. And that becomes very critical when we think about governments that are deploying this, said Reverend Chris Hope, a minister and technologist at the Hope Group. Representative Francisco Paulino said he's not worried that AI will create mass displacement of employees, but of the way AI can standardize discrimination, and Hope suggested that regulators need to figure out how to regulate potential harm categories. When we talk about discrimination, when we talk about manipulation, what we're thinking when we think about displacement, that is, to me, the priority and focus, because it's really more of a moral question as well, Hope said. There's tension between how regulators can balance protecting users and advancing technology, Kevin Bolin, head of AI transformation, strategy, and investments at KPMG, said. The reality is we're not going to bend through this inflection curve right now between the technology and the adoption if we don't close that trust gap, Bolin added. I think any time you have kind of the explosion of technology that we've seen, it's up to the regulators to not only look at the impacts to today, but to forecast where it's going to go. Slower legislative pace is incongruous with the pace technology changes at, he said. So you can't legislate for today. You have to legislate for where it's going to be 3 to 5 years from now. And that's really been hard to predict with the pace of AI's transformation. Meyer said that the state isn't replacing workers with AI, and that its intention is to support existing workers with tools and training to make them more efficient. Specifically for the ChatGPT enterprise, we have our own walled-off enterprise that is not connected to any other model or any other enterprise. It is not training on any models, Myers explained. In addition to an acceptable use policy addressing parameters for usage, there's also a data protection agreement in place, he said. Prior to implementing the contract, the state also did a risk review and privacy impact assessment. A day after signaling they wanted to see an end to the bitter back and forth, justices of the Supreme Judicial Court on Thursday gave Attorney General Andrea Campbell 30 days to decide whether she will represent Auditor Diana DeSoglio in her attempt to sue the legislature. In an order issued after 5 p.m., the court said Campbell shall make a final determination as to the auditor's request for representation within 30 days as it relates to DeSoglio's pursuit of claims against the legislature for alleged failure to respond to 4 specific requests outlined in a January 2025 memo, the official budgets for each chamber of the legislature for fiscal years 2021, 2022, 2023, and 2024, copies of official audits of each chamber for the same fiscal years, a listing of all transactions related to each chamber's balance forward line item for those fiscal years, and a list of all monetary settlement agreements entered into by each chamber with any current or former employees or elected members during the same time frame. This order moves the process forward and ensures the Attorney General must finally make a determination regarding legal representation so the public's interest is prioritized. We are very grateful to the Supreme Judicial Court members for their timely decision, DeSoglio said in a statement Thursday evening. Campbell's office said it would expeditiously comply with the court's order. The AG's office said it was pleased that the auditor has now provided the SJC with the clarity and commitments that we have been seeking, and that the court has entered an order holding her to those representations. Assistant Attorney General Ann Sturman argued during Wednesday's hearing that DeSoglio's office's representation that the audit would be limited to those 4 matters has been wildly inconsistent. The court's Thursday evening order requires Campbell, by June 6th, to file a status report regarding her decision, including a brief statement, without argument, regarding whether the Attorney General continues to seek a ruling on the motion to strike that is pending before this court. Shannon Lisa Riordan, who represented DeSoglio before the SJC on Wednesday, said the auditor's team hopes to hear from the Attorney General that she will withdraw her motion to strike the complaint so that this important case can move forward, so that we may seek to enforce the will of the people. Though Campbell's office has been representing House Speaker Ronald Mariano, Senate President Karen Spilka, and the House and Senate clerks as their office fought to strike DeSoglio's suit against them, it said in court Wednesday and reiterated Thursday that it will now evaluate whether outside counsel is appropriate for either or both sides in the legislative audit dispute. I suspect the likely outcome is that we might end up representing nobody, and the Attorney General weighs in with her view of the law that, you know, lies somewhere in between the two extremes of the two parties, Sturman said in court Wednesday. With an important decision expected on Monday, Governor Maura Healey urged the Supreme Court to do the right thing by maintaining telehealth access to an abortion pill. The Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals in Louisiana last week ruled that mifepristone, a drug commonly used for abortions and sought out via telehealth, can only be distributed at in-person clinics. Days later, Supreme Court Justice Samuel Alito put a one-week hold on the ruling, restoring telehealth access to mifepristone until May 11th. That's the U.S. Supreme Court's deadline to make a decision whether to extend the stay and for how long. I urge the Supreme Court to do the right thing, to protect women's fundamental freedom to make their own health care decisions about their own bodies, Healy said. No matter what the Supreme Court decides, Healy said mifepristone will remain legal in Massachusetts and urged residents to continue seeking the health care they need. Healy also said she's going to do everything she can to ensure women get access to the health care they need, including abortion care and mifepristone. The targeting of mifepristone isn't about health care. The targeting of mifepristone isn't about science. It's an attack on women, the governor said during a press conference Friday. That's what it boils down to. Are you taking away women's access to health care or not? Are you taking away the ability of a woman to make a decision for herself that is about her health or not? The dispute over whether patients should get mifepristone via telehealth and mail delivery comes as the number of abortions performed in the U.S. rose above the amount done before Roe v. Wade was overturned, according to the Guttmacher Institute. Researchers attributed the rise to an increase in medication provided via telehealth to states where abortion is banned. Since the high court left it up to states to decide abortion policies, Republican-led states have moved to restrict abortion, mainly based on pro-life beliefs and in some cases debates over whether unborn fetuses have rights. In 2023, the FDA established a rule allowing mifepristone to be mailed and delivered to patients, including to those in states where abortion is banned. In a 19-page ruling, appeals judge Stuart Kyle Duncan said mailing abortion medication injures Louisiana by undermining its laws protecting unborn human life and could cause the state to spend Medicaid funds on emergency cases for patients harmed by mifepristone. Both injuries are irreparable, Duncan said. Mifepristone is commonly taken with misoprostol, a drug that can also be used alone to induce abortion. More than half of the abortions Planned Parenthood League of Massachusetts provide are through a combination of mifepristone and misoprostol, said the organization's chief medical officer, Dr. Lou Ireland. That combination is the most effective medication for abortion and managing early miscarriages, she said. Last year, Massachusetts providers mailed more than 50,000 medication abortion pills across the country to thousands of patients, said Taylor St. Germain, Reproductive Equity Now's interim executive director and deputy director. St. Germain also said about 30% of all abortions nationwide are done via telehealth medication abortions. This is really the new frontier and how we're ensuring access to care for patients in all 50 states, St. Germain said. Healy said mifepristone is safer than other commonly used drugs, including ibuprofen, acetaminophen, penicillin, and Viagra, which is approved for telehealth. So Viagra is approved for telehealth and mail delivery for men. Mifepristone, the question, is whether that's going to continue to be available for women, be it telehealth and mail delivery, she said. That's how I see it. That's a decision that the Supreme Court is going to make on Monday. The Governor's Council unanimously confirmed Kristen Michaud as a juvenile court judge, and Governor Maura Healey on Wednesday put three new judicial nominees before the vetting panel. Michaud has been an assistant clerk magistrate at the Somerville District Court since July 2021, according to the Governor's office. Before that, she was an attorney and mentor on the Children and Family Law panel and was an assistant district attorney in the Middlesex County District Attorney's Office. Lieutenant Governor Kim Driscoll, who chairs the council, also announced the body received three nominations from Healy: Gregory Bartlett for clerk magistrate in the Southern Berkshire District Court, Georgia Petropoulos for associate justice of the district court, and Allison Silber for a seat on the probate and family court. Bartlett is currently a first assistant clerk magistrate at the Northern Berkshire District Court, a position he's held since 2012, according to his resume. Before that, Bartlett was an assistant district attorney in the Berkshire County District Attorney's Office from 2010 to 2012. Petropoulos has been an attorney at her own Brockton-based legal practice since 2004, according to her resume. She is also on the Committee for Public Counsel Services and was an assistant district attorney for Plymouth County District Attorney's Office. From 1994 to 1996, Petropoulos was a legislative assistant for former Senator Michael Creedon after working as his legal assistant between 1990 and 1994. Silber has run her own legal practice since 2011, where she focuses on family law issues. Silber is also a mediator at Collaborative Resolutions Group and at the Family Resolution Specialty Court within Hampshire Probate and Family Court. In 2016, Silber founded the Solo and Small Firm section within the Hampton County Bar Association. Counselors plan to hold hearings on all the nominations on May 27th. Massachusetts lawmakers and industry leaders are split on how the state should grapple with the energy and climate impacts of data centers that are fueling artificial intelligence as pressure mounts nationally over rising utility costs and environmental strain. The divide surfaced Thursday morning when Representative Francisco Paulino said Beacon Hill needs to start planning for new data centers and AI infrastructure, even after his chamber rejected a proposal to do so last week. While Senator Barry Feingold countered that Massachusetts lacks the power capacity to seriously contemplate the types of massive data centers that are being built in other states. Massachusetts has a small number of these server hubs that process and store data compared to other states where development has taken off, and Feingold said the Bay State's energy capacity inhibits development. In Europe, their electric vehicles are pushing 30% of the total vehicles out there. 30%. Pushing that number, we're probably 5%. We can never get to 30% in our state because we just don't have enough power. So when people talk about data centers, I'm like, we're not even near that. We don't have enough power, Feingold said during a State House News Service and Master List panel on the AI revolution in Massachusetts, Disruption, Risk, Opportunity, at MCLE Conference Center in downtown Boston. The Andover Democrat, who chairs the Joint Committee on Economic Development and Emerging Technologies, said Massachusetts doesn't have the luxury of having the conversation around data centers for about 20 years, until we do a better job of producing power and bringing more power into the state. But we need to start that conversation now, Senator. Paulino responded, we can't wait 20 years to start the conversation, because in 20 years, the situation will be different. The House last week rejected, without debate, a Republican budget amendment calling for a commission to study the impacts of data centers on local communities, including energy and water consumption. The amendment, filed by Representative Kelly Peace, reflected the growing debate unfolding nationwide as communities push back against large-scale data center projects tied to AI expansion. Critics warn the facilities can strain electric grids, increase utility costs, and consume enormous amounts of power, while supporters argue they are essential infrastructure needed to power economic growth. There are 650 bills around the country on data centers, covering everything from proposed moratoriums to tax benefits to everything in between, Stephen Rothstein, Chief Program Officer at sustainability nonprofit Ceres, said. We think there should be a minimum standard to make a data center sustainable. Paulino, who serves on the House Committee on Climate Action and Sustainability, said lawmakers cannot afford to ignore local concerns as AI development accelerates. There is concern about the environment, but also, how will this affect particular communities, Paulino said. When we bring innovation, we need to have input from all stakeholders. The most important stakeholders are the people in those communities. Pressed on whether the House would revisit the topic after rejecting it last week, Paulino said, of course. Yes, we will revisit it, he said. We need to consider the impact of those data centers, but also the effect that this new development will have in the Commonwealth day to day. Feingold said the state is both failing to produce enough of its own energy and not bringing in enough energy from elsewhere to support major data center development. I wish we could have the conversation, but there's certain parts of our state that you're like, I want to start a company, and you're like, I can't get enough power, he said. Rothstein warned that it's not just a question of energy, but of natural resources. Data centers consume millions of gallons of water for evaporative cooling to keep major computer servers running. He pointed out that most of Massachusetts has been in a drought since 2024. If there's drought, you can't build. I was with a company in California 6 months ago that got a $30 million purchase order. They couldn't accept it because they couldn't get a water permit because of a drought, he said. We're not in that situation today, that bad, but if we're not aware of it, we will be in terms of heat and water and impact. At one point, Rothstein used a water bottle as a prop to illustrate AI's hidden resource demands. If you go back to your office today, your school, and you say 10 times you're going to go to AI to ask a question, that's like 10 times dumping this on the street, he said, gesturing to the bottle. When we're using AI, we are wasting an enormous amount if they're not built from a data center that's sustainable. These climate concerns are halting data center development across the country and globe. There's a lot of data centers being developed, he said. But also, there's $154 billion of data center development put on hold because of community opposition. Lowell in March passed a year-long moratorium on data center development, and there are campaigns in other cities and towns hoping to follow suit. Rothstein said developers and policymakers could reduce resistance by requiring sustainability measures and community benefits, including weatherization programs for low-income households, renewable energy use, and water offset projects. "These are not radical ideas," Rothstein said. "You can make a data center a community asset, not a community liability." Kevin Bolin, KPMG's head of AI transformation, strategy, and investments, said that AI could create a new space of job creation and innovation to solve the very problems the technology creates. "The data center concerns are valid, and the power constraints are valid. The water constraints are valid," Bolin said. "It creates a secondary innovation market where people solve those problems." Bolin described emerging technologies ranging from lower power computer chips to experimental small-scale backyard nuclear fusion reactors to power the centers, saying he did not believe energy limitations would permanently constrain AI development. "I look at a lot of the energy that's going around to solve those challenges, and I don't think that's going to be the limit. 5 to 10 years from now, we will work past that, because as a society, you can't live without water. We can't afford $9,000 electric bills for our house every day because the data center down the street sucked it all up," he said. "That's not sustainable," Bolin said. "We will have to break through those barriers." The discussion underscored a tension lawmakers will have to contend with as Massachusetts positions itself as a hub for AI innovation while also pursuing aggressive climate goals and confronting already high utility costs. "If we don't have those conversations, those risks that we are so afraid of, they will be dominating us," Paulino said. "They will be defining us." As the legislative prescription sits idle, the Healey administration this week gave businesses and consumers the lay of the legal land as pennies dry up from circulation and rounding is introduced at retail. The U.S. Treasury Department ceased production of the penny last year after it determined making more of the coins would not be fiscally responsible or necessary to meet the needs of commerce in the United States, given the increase in non-cash transactions and the very low purchasing power of a single penny. When the last Lincolns were minted in November, it cost 3.669 cents to manufacture one penny, the Treasury said. Since then, shortages of the coin have led some Federal Reserve regions to stop supplying and accepting pennies. With the universe of pennies now capped, some retailers, including the ubiquitous Dunkin', have implemented policies that round customers' change up to the nearest nickel so the retailer doesn't have to dole out the 1 cent pieces. On Tuesday, the Department of Revenue and Division of Standards each issued guidance on the new landscape. Revenue Commissioner Jeffrey Snyder and Commissioner of Standards Dave Rodriguez said they wanted to clear up the questions businesses have about how state law interacts with their penny policies. DOS said rounding up or down is permitted under Massachusetts law as long as it is applied to the total transaction price, not individual item prices. DOR made explicit that rounding a cash payment does not change the amount of sales tax owed. Businesses must calculate and collect sales tax based on the exact purchase price, even if the final cash total is rounded up or down, the department said. To protect consumers, DOS recommends that any business choosing to round cash transactions clearly post its policy at entrances and points of sale, including in multiple languages where appropriate, the Executive Office for Administration and Finance said. Before completing a transaction that includes rounding, businesses should also offer customers the option to pay using another method, such as a card or exact change. In February, Representative Tacky Chan filed a bill to simplify things for people who pay with cash and eliminate a situation in which each retailer pinches pennies differently by setting a standard set of rounding rules for cash transactions across Massachusetts businesses. That bill got a hearing last month and is still pending before the Committee on Consumer Protection and Professional Licensure. You've been listening to an episode of the Massachusetts Statehouse News Service, a program produced by Audio Journal and sponsored by the Memorial Foundation for the Blind and the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind. This is Paula Simchak. Thank you for listening. Stay tuned for more informative programming by Audio Journal.
Hello, listeners. Would you like to hear news from Holden, Paxton, Princeton, Rutland, and Sterling that you're not likely to hear on commercial television and radio? Tune in to Audio Journal every Friday at 7 a.m. and again at 9 a.m. Thank you for listening to Audio Journal.
You are listening to Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. Would you like to hear news from Gardner that you're not likely to hear on commercial television or radio? Then tune into Audio Journal every Wednesday at 6 p.m.